America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, and a great day to break tradition. What tradition? On President's Day, or on any day when we are talking about our presidents, there's a great tendency for people to focus on the best and the brightest, the greatest presidents we ever had. The same names always come up. Washington, of course, Lincoln, usually both of the Roosevelts, Jefferson, Reagan. Those are the people people love to talk about. But this particular day, we want to take an opposite approach and do something that might be even more worthwhile. Instead of looking at the all-time greats, we are going to take a special and important and deeply meaningful look at the worst presidents ever. Now, why would we do that? Well, I'll tell you, there's several reasons. And one of them is that basically, when it comes to Washington and Lincoln, no future leader can ever hope to replicate their epic achievements. These guys are in a class by themselves. They faced unique challenges, and they had unique gifts and greatness that very, very few people can ever aspire to imitate or emulate. However, every single president, including the current incumbent, can, should, must avoid some of the leadership mistakes, some of the weaknesses, some of the stupidities of people like Tyler and Pierce and Johnson and Hoover and their feckless fellow travelers in the road to the presidential hall of shame. There is a general agreement about who the greatest presidents of the United States are. The same names come up. They started this practice of offering presidential polls. Life magazine, in November of 1948, asked a famous Harvard historian, Arthur Schlesinger Sr. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. became the more famous historian, and he took up his father's practice, asked him to go ahead and survey leading historians, and then to rank the presidents in order, from first, second, third, on down to the very bottom. And that was in 1948. Now, since that time, there have been many, many other polls, but all the polls have the same numbers one and two. Washington first and Lincoln second, or more often, it's Lincoln first and Washington second. In more recent polls, Franklin Roosevelt is always third. But when it comes to the bottom of the list, there's all kinds of arguments. But one name that generally appears very near the bottom of the list, except there's one very eccentric list, which we'll get to, that rates him as the greatest president who ever lived, is John Tyler. John Tyler, if he's known at all today by the general public, it's only because he was part of the most famous campaign slogan of all time. And that slogan was given life and given rise by a famous campaign song in the Great Campaign of 1840.
Oh, who has heard the great commotion, motion, motion all the country through? It is the ball a-rollin' on for Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. For Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. And with him will beat little Van. Van, Van is a used-up man. And with him will beat little Van.
Little Van was Martin Van Buren, who was their opponent.
Talk about hard cider, 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 and log cabins, too. Will only help to speed the ball for Tippecanoe and Tyler too. For Tippecanoe and Tyler too. And with him will beat little Van. Van, Van is a used up man. And with him will beat.
You might get
Van.
The idea that this wasn't a very substantive campaign. What are they singing about? They're singing about log cabins and hard cider. That was the slogan of the campaign because there had been a newspaper in Baltimore that said the presidential candidate, who was William Henry Harrison, was only interested in two things, which was a log cabin and drinking hard cider. So they made the most of that. And they talk about rolling balls. They use these big canvas balls. And this was one of the first organized populist campaigns. And they had slogans and they distributed this song everywhere. There was an American snooty publication after the campaign that said that the song Tippecanoe and Tyler too was the American equivalent of the Marseillaise. It created a political revolution. and it swept William Henry Harrison and John Tyler into power. When it says Tyler II, it was a strange association. And it was a strange association because these two guys did not see eye to eye politically. Tippecanoe was William Henry Harrison. He had the nickname Tippecanoe because he was best known as a frontier general. Though he had been around for a long time, he had run for president before he was 68 years old, which made him the oldest person elected president before Ronald Reagan. And Old Tippecanoe got that title because in 1811, some 30 years before he became president, he had fought the Indian chief Tecumseh at the Battle of Tippecanoe and won a great victory, killing about 200 Indians. So Old Tippecanoe and Tyler too. So who was Tyler? People didn't know. They didn't care. But suddenly they had reason to care. Here's what happened. I mentioned that William Henry Harrison was the oldest person elected president before Reagan. He was also very curmudgeonly. And he was determined that he was going to deliver an inaugural address that laid out his entire political philosophy. The inaugural address that he delivered in a cold and windy day lasted for over an hour and 45 minutes. Okay, try to imagine this. You're standing there listening to this old man droning on and on and on. I've tried to read this inaugural address. I mean, it's about nothing. It's just about as general as it could be. And people were getting extremely worried that he was going to use up all of his first term in delivering this inaugural address. And it was very cold, and he insisted on doing this without a top hat or without a coat. Anyway, he caught pneumonia. And he got very, very seriously ill, and things didn't go well. The medical treatment at the time was not very good, and people saw that President Harrison was sick. Vice President Tyler didn't realize how sick he was, became sicker because doctors applied suction cups to his right side in the belief that the infection could be drawn out through the skin. Then they administered doses of castor oil, snakeweed root, opium, yes, petroleum, that's like oil from the ground, brandy, and other remedies. The patient was basically defenseless here. He was being attacked by his physicians. A siege of vomiting and diarrhea weakened the president beyond rescue, and he died. He died exactly 1 month in office. He had never really served as president because he'd been sick the whole time from that inaugural address, which represented, again, still by far the record setter. I know some of President Obama's speeches sometimes feel like they're that long, but William Henry Harrison really did it. So he's gone. The day he died, John Quincy Adams, former president himself, wrote in his diary, "At 30 minutes past midnight this morning of Palm Sunday, the 4th of April, 1841, died William Henry Harrison, precisely one calendar month, president of the United States after his inauguration. The influence of this event upon the condition and history of the country can scarcely be seen. It makes the vice president of the United States, John Tyler of Virginia, acting president of the Union for 4 years less 1 month. In upwards of half a century, this is the first instance of a vice president's being called to act as president of the United States and brings to the test that provision of the Constitution which places in the executive chair a man never thought of for it by anybody." And then Adams apparently looked up at the window and he said, "This day was in every sense gloomy, rain the whole day." How gloomy was it? People didn't know who Tyler was at the time, just as people don't seem to know who he is today. And he had been put on the ticket simply to try to appeal to Southern voters by this Whig Party, which was basically an assemblage of people who were just opposed to Andrew Jackson and Martin Van Buren, Jackson's chosen successor. So all of a sudden, John Tyler is president. He was at his home in Williamsburg, Virginia, when he got the news that that Harrison had died. And he got the news from the son of the Secretary of State, Daniel Webster. And then he had to ride back to Washington and didn't know what to do. Does he become president? Or just acting president? That was one of the first decisions he had to make and may have been the only decision he made effectively. What else happened with John Tyler and the others who followed? You'll find out as we continue this saga of the worst presidents ever. On this special edition of the Michael Medved Show, The Worst Presidents Ever, you're listening to the music of General Harrison's Log Cabin March and Quickstep. It was written to celebrate William Henry Harrison's inauguration as a president, and when the musicians finally got to play after he delivered his 1 hour and 45 minute fatal inaugural address, they must have sounded about as tired as these particular musicians do. And out of tune, too. Meanwhile, John Tyler was an out-of-tune choice to be the vice president of the United States. What happened here is that Henry Clay, who was the leader of the Whig Party had emerged as an odd coalition of all kinds of disparate points of view and representatives from different factions who came together. The only thing they had in common was they didn't like Andrew Jackson, and they didn't like his protege, Martin Van Buren. They didn't like the Democratic Party that Jackson had really built around him. And they centered around Henry Clay, the great Kentucky senator, Speaker of the House, Secretary of State, who ran for president and lost three different times. And Henry Clay actually was manipulating almost everything regarding the Whig Party. And the way that Tyler ended up on the ticket running together with General Harrison is that Tyler had a peculiar habit. Is he usually would get elected to offices and then resign. Now, why would he do that? He was the son of a very distinguished judge and a briefly serving governor of Virginia. His father owned 40 slaves. He grew up on a very luxurious and beautiful plantation in Virginia. He went to the College of William and Mary. He was always considered a very bright guy. He loved hunting. He played the violin superbly, like his fellow Virginian Thomas Jefferson did. He was considered very gracious, aristocratic, and charming. And he made a striking appearance. He had a long, thin face and a particularly long, elegantly beaked nose. As a matter of fact, one of the stories that I find very, very amusing is that there was a report in the newspapers that two Americans were visiting Naples, and they were on an excavation of an archaeological dig in Naples, and they dug up a bust of the great Roman orator Cicero. And when they dug the bust out of the ground, the Americans immediately shouted out, "President Tyler," because he had a long Roman nose. Tyler, however, picked up from his father a very, very strong devotion to states' rights. He did not believe in a strong federal government. In fact, his father had opposed the Constitution of the United States. He did not want to see the Constitution ratified, and he was only partially modified by the Bill of Rights. Tyler started out as a Jeffersonian, and he went back and forth to different parties, just like he went back and forth to different offices. It's really extraordinary to read about his career before the presidency, because he's elected to the Virginia House of Delegates as a very young man, and then he is elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. He resigns because he's frustrated. After 5 years, then he's reelected to the Virginia House of Delegates again, and then he resigns because he's elected to be governor of Virginia. Then he resigns from that post. Do you see a pattern here? And then he is elected to the United States Senate, and he resigns, goes back to the Virginia House of Delegates. Meanwhile, he's switching parties all over the place. And he really did feel that he was too good for politics, but he couldn't say no to it. And what happened for the vice presidency is he was planning to go back and run for the Senate again, I guess, so he could resign again. And Henry Clay had his own candidate for the Virginia Senate. He said, "Look, Mr. Tyler, don't run for that office. We have another Whig candidate we'd like to put. We'll put you on as vice president." And he thought about it for a while, and vice president seemed to be a totally meaningless job at this point. There had never been a vice president who became president. No president had ever died. And When John Tyler became president, and he claimed that, no, he should become president, not acting president, there was some debate as to the language in the Constitution. Did the language of the Constitution said when the president dies, the vice president becomes president, or the vice president just assumes the president's duties? Tyler insisted that he become president, that he move into the White House, and that was probably the right decision, though it was the wrong decision. We found out years later, after Tyler made this decision, they actually found some of the letters and papers of the Constitutional Convention. And it's pretty clear that the founders did not assume that the vice president would become president. But Tyler was the first in so many regards of the people to sit in what was called the presidential chair at that point. He was the first no-name, unknown, John who. As a matter of fact, when he was running for vice president with William Henry Harrison, despite the fact that they had this snazzy slogan, Tippecanoe and Tyler too, a lot of Whigs didn't like the idea that Tyler was there. He had been a Democrat and he had been a Whig, and so they did another verse, and it says, "And we'll vote for Tyler, therefore, without a why or wherefore." In other words, don't worry about it. General Harrison will be fine. We don't have to worry about this guy. But if you look at who had been president of the United States up till that point, the presidents of the United States had not been people with long political careers and careers where they resigned every darn office. They had been people who had been, as John Adams had, George Washington, we know, general-in-chief, military hero, Andrew Jackson, military hero, William Henry Harrison, big military hero, plus having held various elective offices and been in politics. And the other presidents, Madison and Monroe and Adams and Jefferson, had been either vice president or secretary of state or both. And here's John Tyler. So he becomes president and he confronts his cabinet. And basically they say, well, okay, we have this big agenda because we Whigs have been out of power now for 12 years. And there's a bunch of stuff that we basically meant to do. We want to do internal improvements, which means working on infrastructure, building roads and canals. We want a high protective tariff to encourage industry. And we also want to reestablish the national bank that Jackson had wrecked. Tyler said, no, I don't think so. Meanwhile, Henry Clay actually had a meeting with Tyler, and these are two fiery personalities. And at the meeting, Clay stood up and he shouted at the president and he said, I demand a bank now. He wanted the national bank. Then Tyler replied, then, sir, I wish you to understand this, that you and I were born in the same district, that we have fed upon the same food, and to breathe the same natal air. Go you now, then, Mr. Clay, to your end of the avenue, where stands the Capitol, and there perform your duty to your country as you shall think proper. So help me God, I shall do mine at this end of it, and I shall think proper. They didn't speak again, which was a disaster. There were reasons that John Tyler became known not only as his accidency, but as old veto. He didn't get very far as president, but he did make progress in romance. We will get to that and more in this special broadcast, The Worst Presidents Ever. On this special edition of the Michael Medved Show, The Worst Presidents Ever, we're talking about John Tyler of Virginia, the arrogant aristocrat who found himself suddenly president, though most Americans had no idea who he was. They soon learned because of his epic battles with his own party. The Whigs had won a huge victory in 1840, their hard cider and log cabin campaign. And all of a sudden, here is John Tyler vetoing the National Bank bill. He did that, and then he let it be known in a cabinet meeting, well, if they would readjust and pass a new National Bank bill with a few details changed, he would sign it. They did. They brought the bill back. He vetoed it again. At this point, his whole cabinet resigned. This is not good. There was only one cabinet member who stayed, and he stayed because he was drinking again, and that was Daniel Webster, the great orator. And one of the factors that all the historians agree upon is one of the reasons that Webster stayed is because he was involved in negotiations with Britain in what became the Webster-Ashburton Treaty, settling a boundary dispute in the Aroostook Valley in Maine. But also, he needed a job. Webster didn't have any money, and he was no longer in the United States Senate. He was Secretary of State, so he stayed with Tyler for a while longer. By the time his term was over, old Vito had set a one-term record of vetoing 10 bills, enraging the Whig Party almost beyond belief because they had waited for this moment. Here they had the presidency, and now Tyler was turning on them. He did not believe in a strong activist federal government, which is one of the reasons, by the way, that in one book, at least, he is rated very highly as a president because he was such a strong believer in a passive executive and basically a very strong emphasis on states' rights. He was also a defender and a practitioner and slave owner who later, after his retirement, actually became a member of the Confederate States of America Congress. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. The point is, Tyler wanted to continue as president. He clearly wasn't going to win any Whig nominations as president. The Whigs hated him. How much did they hate him? The leading political manager for the Whigs party was the close friend of William Henry Seward of New York, Thurlow Weed. And here's what Thurlow Weed said about John Tyler. John Tyler, the poor, miserable, despised imbecile, who now goes from the presidential chair, scorned of all parties, but for his profligate and disgraceful, though impotent, efforts for a re-election, would have passed at least decently through his official course. At one point, Tyler attempted to get the Democratic nomination. They didn't want him. And then he moved over and organized what he called the Tyler Party, modestly. And they nominated him for president. What a surprise. This was, by the way, he had 23 different cabinet members, and this at a time far more than any of his predecessors because the people kept resigning. But there was another problem, which is, and it occurred toward the very end of his term, and it was one of the most significant events of his life, as it turns out, because what happened here was toward the end of his term, the Navy had commissioned a great big new boat designed by a famous Swedish engineer named John Ericsson. The boat was called the USS Princeton. The boat had a huge gun on it that they were very proud could have been the biggest naval gun in the world. So they had, at the very last year of Tyler's presidency, they had a large demonstration of Tyler and bringing people on for reception while they were firing this gun. The gun was called the Peacemaker. Paul Johnson says it was tempting of Providence to call any gun the Peacemaker. But what happened while all this celebration was going on and people were drinking and they were riding on the USS Princeton down, sailing along the Potomac, they fired the Peacemaker successfully and then they had a few more drinks. Tyler was below deck, but most of his cabinet was above deck. And they called the president up. They were going to fire the Peacemaker again. The president was stopped on the stairway by his son-in-law, who was drunk and who was singing some kind of ditty and wanted Tyler to hear the end of the song. In any event, the gun exploded. It killed the Secretary of State, Abel Upshur. It killed the Secretary of War. It killed a New York State senator named John Gardner. And Gardner's beautiful daughter, 23-year-old Julia Gardner, fainted, seeing her father blown to smithereens and a bunch of other dead bodies and blood and everything. President Tyler rushed up, having just barely escaped death himself. Remember, there's no vice president now because he was the vice president, became president. He picks up this beautiful young girl. She's 30 years younger than him. And then a bit later, he marries her. How did that work? We will get to that and more successors among the White House worst in this very special broadcast.
This
listeners love Michael Medved.
I love your show. It is a thinking man show. Your competition often speaks from talking points over and over and over, and does not allow for the opposition. You invite the opposition, and I appreciate that.
You are the host I probably disagree with the most, but one of the best that I love to listen to, because you tell it like it is, like you see it, and you let other people have an argument with you.
The Michael Medved Show.
This special edition of the Michael Medved Show devoted to the worst presidents ever. John Tyler, president of the United States, his accidency, old veto as he was known, the man without a party. He had actually been formally expelled from the Whig Party, which is the only time that that's happened to any American president. But in February 28th, 1844, there was this dramatic disaster in which two members of his cabinet and an American diplomat and President Tyler's black valet and a sailor had all been killed. And Tyler had gallantly rescued this 23-year-old woman who was 30 years younger than the 53-year-old president. And he had sort of carried her off in a boat. They almost sank as they were rowing away on the boat. So he almost died a second time that day, which would have been a true disaster, because there were problems because there was no vice president. We didn't have the 25th Amendment where we had actually provided for presidential succession. But here is a part of the interesting story is the way it was reported in the press was this was the ultimate meet cute in Hollywood terms, is the gallant president rescuing this beautiful young woman. She was quite a famous beauty, as a matter of fact. She was known as the Rose of Long Island. Her family owned Gardner's Island, which is considered to still to be a very elite reserve. And certainly it was a family of considerable money. She had been billed as the Rose of Long Island in an advertising circular. So she was the equivalent of a model in the 1840s. And despite the fact that much of the press and even some subsequent historians have suggested that Tyler actually met her the day of the Princeton disaster, he had met her before after his first wife, Letitia, had died. Now, Tyler wasn't very good at running the country or at occupying the White House or acting as president. That was very clear. He left office with scant support and very little respect from any quarter. But he was very good at love. His first wife, Letitia, gave him 8 surviving children. And when she died, he was lost without an adoring woman at his side. And so literally a few months later, he met this famous beauty, Julia Gardner, and he proposed to her. He's president of the United States. She's 30 years younger. She said, "No, you're too old, sir." But after the event on the Princeton, she agreed to marry him, and literally within 6 months of her father's death, seeing her father blown up before her eyes, she became first lady. The president slipped away. At the middle of the time that he was romancing Julia and marrying her, he was also running for president.
You're listening to a special history broadcast of the Michael Medved Show. For a complete list of history shows, visit medvedhistorystore.com.
He was very good at love. His first wife, Letitia, gave him 8 surviving children. And when she died, he was lost without an adoring woman at his side. And so literally a few months later, he met this famous beauty, Julia Gardner, and he proposed to her. He's president of the United States. She's 30 years younger. She said, "No, you're too old, sir." But after the event on the Princeton, she agreed to marry him. And literally within 6 months of her father's death, seeing her father blown up before her eyes, she became first lady. The president slipped away. At the middle of the time that he was romancing Julia and marrying her, he was also running for president. He only withdrew as a candidate for president with the Tyler Party, because the thing that he cared about most at the very end of his administration was the annexation of Texas. Texas had gained its independence. It was an independent country thanks to the leadership of Sam Houston. But Tyler was one of those people, and James K. Polk, who was the Democratic nominee, was another one, who believed that Texas should become part of the Union. This was controversial in the North because Texas would come in, of course, as another slave state. And Henry Clay, Tyler's old nemesis, who was the Whig candidate, opposed the annexation of Texas. Tyler withdrew as a candidate, allowing Polk to win when Polk supported the annexation of Texas. And then when Polk won the election, very close election, and it was after this particular election that Henry Clay famously said, "I would rather be right than president," which is sort of the ultimate line for a sore loser. But after that, his great achievement was that Tyler, because Polk supported it, was able to put through the annexation of Texas at the very end of his term. He then retired to his Virginia plantation, Sherwood Forest, and there he proceeded to have seven more surviving children with Julia. That gave him a total of 15 children who lived into adulthood, far more than any other president. What else had he left behind? Well, he left behind at least one admirer. There's a peculiar book that came out in 2009, and it's called Recarving Rushmore, Ranking the Presidents on Peace, Prosperity, and Liberty. It's by a guy named Ivan Eland, who is very much a libertarian and a constitutionalist, and he opposes executive power. He writes in his book that in U.S. history, presidential activism has proved pernicious for the Republic. He lists among his worst presidents Lincoln, Jackson, Jefferson, Reagan, Franklin Roosevelt, Truman, his best president of all, John Tyler. Why? Because no president ever did more to reduce or limit presidential power than John Tyler. John Hough, who worked in the Bush administration and is a constitutional law professor at the University of California at Berkeley, he wrote recently that every president should seek to leave the office stronger than when he found it. And that seems good advice. That was not advice that John Tyler followed. But when John Tyler left office in 1845, he didn't know, no one could know, that 12 years later, a new president would come to office who seemed almost snake-bit to have bad luck surrounding him, along with problems of alcoholism, almost like a dark cloud. And that president was also considered to be perhaps the most handsome, the most charismatic individual ever elected to the presidency. He went by a nickname, the Young Hickory of the Granite Hills. You know a president's in trouble when the best thing about him is his nickname. The Young Hickory of the Granite Hills? That Young Hickory of the Granite Hills was Franklin Pierce. And the beginning of his administration was punctuated by horrifying and tragic death that wrecked that administration before it even began. Franklin Pierce not only presided over the country at a troubled time, but one could say that his disastrous presidency made civil war inevitable. We will get to more amazing aspects of his story, including the first seance, but not the last, the first seance in White House history, in this special broadcast, The Worst Presidents Ever.
To purchase this special show, go to medvidhistorystore.com.
Hey, this is Rockstar Greg with The Michael Medved Show. Thanks for listening to the special history broadcast. If you want even more content from Michael Medved, go to our website, michaelmedved.com, and consider becoming a Medhead. It's $5 a month for a year subscription, and there's so much content available. The 3-hour daily broadcast, commercial-free, hundreds of commentaries, 2 new podcasts, and lots more. It's all at michaelmedved.com. Click on the Medhead subscription and become a member. Thanks for listening in this greatest nation on God's green earth.
this special broadcast of the Medved Show, The Worst Presidents Ever. It's part of our series of special history programs. For more information on how you can get these programs, either in audio download or on CD format, go to MedvedHistoryStore.com. That's MedvedHistoryStore.com. Talking about Franklin Pierce, he became the youngest man yet elected president when he won the Democratic nomination. He was a surprise nominee in 1852. And one of the problems for Pierce was he was the son of a governor, privileged guy, very handsome guy. One of his nicknames, in addition to Young Hickory, a reference to Old Hickory, Andrew Jackson, Young History of the Hickory of the Granite Hills, one of his other nicknames was Handsome Frank. And he was an impressive guy who developed a drinking problem in college. In college, he became best friends with the novelist Nathaniel Hawthorne. And that friendship was important to Pierce for his whole life. His marriage was more problematic. He went to Bowdoin College in Maine. He married the very aristocratic and intellectual and deeply religious daughter of the college president. And Jane Pierce became obsessed with their children. They had three boys. The first two boys died, one in infancy, and the other as a young child, leading Jane to, during his last sickness, Franklin Pierce resigned from the United States Senate, went back to New Hampshire. In any event, he had been elected president of the United States. They had one surviving son who was not yet 12. He was approaching his 12th birthday. His name was Benny, and he was the apple of his father's eye. They went to attend a funeral on a train, and the funeral was of one of Jane's uncles. And they had a private car. He was president-elect. He had won the election. He's elected president. It's 1852. It's December. And they're riding back home on the train car, and the train car, in a freak accident, uncoupled, derailed, and then tumbled 20 feet down an embankment. People who saw the wreck assume the president-elect had been killed, which would have been a huge disaster. He was badly scratched, but he was okay. Mrs. Pierce was okay. Their son, Benny, had been thrown with his head landing against a boulder, and it opened up a huge gash in the back of his head, and when his mother found him, there was tissue and brain matter and blood covering his face, which was a sight they never forgot. He died. When they became occupants of the White House, Jane Pierce went upstairs and basically never came out. She didn't appear in public for 2 years. She spent all her time locked in her room writing letters to her dead son. This blighted the presidency of Franklin Pierce. But it wasn't all. There was more death, a herald of far more death to come for the country. We will get to that story and more. Important to learn these stories, to learn the kind of presidents to avoid and the kind of mistakes to avoid as worthy presidents and leaders of this greatest nation on God's green earth.
To purchase this show, go to MedvidHistoryStore.com.